Boeing's aircraft, which, Wise figured, was about as likely as having a pickpocket walk into the Oval Office and lift the president's wallet. But the military followed its own rules, senseless though they might be. That was something he remembered well from his time in the Corps. So he'd drive down, pass through all the checkpoints, whose guards knew him better than they knew their own CO, and wait in the plush, distinguished visitor's lounge at the end of Andrews Runway 01 left for the official party to arrive. Then they'd board the venerable VC-137 for the endless flight to Beijing. The seats were as comfortable as they could be on an airplane, and the service was as good as any airline's first class. But flights this long were never fun. "Never been there before," Mark Gant said, answering George Winston's question. "So, what's the score on this Rutledge guy?" The Sec-Trez shrugged. "Career State Department puke, worked his way pretty far up the ladder. Used to have good political connections. He was tight with Ed Kielty once upon a time." The former stock trader looked up. "Oh? Why hasn't Ryan fired his ass?" "Jack doesn't play that sort of game," Winston replied, wondering if in this case principle was getting in the way of common sense. "George, he's still pretty naive, isn't he?" "Maybe so, but he's a straight shooter, and I can live with that. He sure as hell backed us up on tax policy, and that's going to pass through Congress in another few weeks." Gant wouldn't believe that until he saw it. "Assuming every lobbyist in town doesn't jump in front of the train." That engendered an amused grunt. "So the wheels get greased a little better. You know, wouldn't it be nice to close all those bastards down?" "George," Gant couldn't say in this office, "if you believe that, you've been hanging out with the president too long." "But idealism wasn't all that bad a thing, was it?" "I'll settle for squeezing those Chinese bastards on the trade balance." "Ryan's going to back us up?" "All the way, he says." "And I believe him, Mark." "I guess we'll see. I hope this Rutledge guy can read numbers."
"He went to Harvard," Secretary Winston observed.
"I know," Gant said back. He had his own academic prejudice, having graduated from the University of Chicago 20 years earlier. What the hell was Harvard except a name and an endowment? Winston chuckled. "They're not all dumb." "I suppose we'll see, boss. Anyway," he lifted his suitcase up on its rollers. His computer bag went over his shoulder. "My car's waiting downstairs." "Good trip, Mark." Her name was Yang Lianhua. She was 34, 9 months pregnant, and very frightened. It was her second pregnancy. Her first had been a son whom they had named Zhu Long, a particularly auspicious given name, which translated roughly as large dragon. But the youngster had died at the age of 4, bumped by a bicycle off the sidewalk into the path of a passenger bus. His death had devastated his parents, and even saddened the local Communist Party officials who'd officiated at the inquest, which had absolved the bus driver of guilt and never identified the careless bicyclist. The loss had been sufficiently hard on Mrs. Yang that she'd sought comfort in a way that this country's government did not especially approve. That way was Christianity, the foreign religion despised in fact, if not exactly in law. In another age, she might have found solace in the teachings of Buddha or Confucius. But these too had been largely erased from the public consciousness by the Marxist government, which still regarded all religion as a public narcotic. A co-worker had quietly suggested that she meet a friend of hers, a man named Yu Fa An. Mrs. Yang had sought him out, and so had begun her first adventure in treason. Reverend Yu, she found, was a well-educated and traveled man, which added to his stature in her eyes. He was also a fine listener, who attended to her every word, occasionally pouring her some sympathetic tea, and gently touching her hand when tears streamed down her face. Only when she had finished her tale of woe had he begun his own lessons. Zhu Long, he told her, was with God,
because God was especially solicitous to the needs of innocent children. While she could not see her son at this moment, her son could see her, looking down from heaven. And while her sorrow was completely understandable, she should believe that the God of the earth was a God of mercy and love, who had sent his only begotten Son to earth to show mankind the right path, and to give his own life for the sins of humanity. He handed her a Bible printed in the Goyu, the national language of the PRC, also called Mandarin, and helped her find appropriate passages. It had not been easy for Mrs. Yang, but so deep was her grief that she kept returning for private counseling, finally bringing along her husband, Quan. Mr. Yang proved a harder sell on any religion. He'd served his time in the People's Liberation Army, where he'd been thoroughly indoctrinated in the politics of his nation, and done sufficiently well in his test answers to be sent off to sergeant school, for which political reliability was required. But Quan had been a good father to his little large dragon, and he too found the void in his belief system too large to bridge easily. This bridge the Reverend Yu provided, and soon both of the Yangs came to his discreet church services, and gradually they'd come to accept their loss with confidence in the continued life of Julong, and the belief that they would someday see him again in the presence of an almighty God, whose existence became increasingly real to both of them. Until then, life had to go on. Both worked at their jobs as factory workers in the same factory, with a working-class apartment in the Dianmen district of Beijing near Jingshan, Coal Hill Park. They labored at their factory during the day, watched state-run television at night, and in due course, Lianhua became pregnant again, and ran afoul of the government's population control policy that was well to the left of draconian. It had long since been decreed that any married couple could have but one child. A second pregnancy required official government permission. Though this was not generally denied to those whose first child had died, pro forma permission had to be obtained, and in the case of politically unacceptable parents, this permission was generally withheld as a method of controlling the living population as well. That meant that an unauthorized pregnancy had to be terminated, safely and at state expense in a state hospital, but terminated. Christianity translated exactly into political unreliability for the communist government, and unsurprisingly the Ministry of State Security had inserted intelligence officers into Reverend Yu's congregation. This individual, actually there were three, lest one be corrupted by religion and become unreliable himself, had entered the names of the Yangs on a master list of political unreliables. For that reason, when Mrs. Yang Lianhua had duly registered her pregnancy, an official letter had appeared in her box, instructing her to go to the Longfu Hospital located on Meishuguan Street for a therapeutic abortion. This Lianhua was unwilling to do. Her given name translated as Lotus Flower, but inside she was made of much sterner stuff. She wrote a week later to the appropriate government agency, telling them that her pregnancy had miscarried. Given the nature of bureaucracies, her lie was never checked out. That lie had merely won Lotus Flower 6 months of ever-increasing stress. She never saw a physician, not even one of the barefoot medics that the PRC had invented a generation earlier, much to the admiration of political leftists all over the world. Lianhua was healthy and strong, and the human body had been designed by nature to produce healthy offspring long before the advent of obstetricians. Her swelling belly she was able to hide, mostly, in her ill-fitting clothing. What she could not hide, at least from herself, was her inward fear. She carried a new baby in her belly. She wanted it. She wanted to have another chance at motherhood. She wanted to feel her child suckling at her breast. She wanted to love it and pamper it, watch it learn to crawl and stand and walk and talk, to see it grow beyond 4 years, enter school, learn and grow into a good adult of whom she could be proud. The problem was politics. The state enforced its will with ruthlessness. She knew what could happen. the syringe filled with formaldehyde stabbed into the baby's head at the very moment of birth. In China, it was state policy. For the Yangs, it was premeditated, cold-blooded murder. And they were determined not to lose a second child, who, the Reverend Yu had told them, was a gift from God himself. And there was a way. If you delivered the baby at home without medical assistance, and if the baby took its first breath, then the state would not kill it. There were some things even the government of the People's Republic quailed at, and the killing of a living, breathing human infant was one of them. But until it took that breath, it was of no more consequence than a piece of meat in a market. There were even rumors that the Chinese government was selling organs from the aborted newborns on the world's tissue market, to be used for medical purposes. And that was something the Yangs were able to believe. So their plan was for Lianhua to deliver the child at home, after which they would present their state with a fait accompli, and eventually have it baptized by Reverend Yu. To this end, Mrs. Yang had kept herself in good physical shape, walking 2 kilometers every day, eating sensibly, and generally doing all the things the government-published booklets told expectant mothers to do. And if anything went badly wrong, they'd go to Reverend Yu for counsel and advice. The plan enabled Lianhua to deal with the stress. In fact, it was a heart-rending terror of her unauthorized condition. "Well?" Ryan asked. "Rutledge has all the right talents, and we've given him the instructions he needs. He ought to carry them out properly. Question is, will the Chinese play ball?" "If they don't, things become harder for them," the president said. "If not coldly, then with some degree of determination. If they think they can bully us, Scott, it's time they found out who the big kid in the playground is." "They'll fight back. They've taken out options on 14 Boeing 777s. Just did that 4 days ago, remember? That's the first thing they'll chop if they don't like us. That's a lot of money and a lot of jobs for Boeing in Seattle," Sextate warned. "I never have been real big on blackmail, Scott. Besides, that's a classic case of penny-wise, pound-foolish. If we cave because of that, then we lose 10 times the money and 10 times the jobs elsewhere. Okay, they won't all be in one place, and so the TV news guys won't be able to point their cameras, and so they won't do the real story, just the one that can fit on half-inch tape. But I'm not in here to keep the goddamn media happy. I'm here to serve the people to the best of my ability, Scott. And that's, by God, going to happen," POTUS promised his guest. "I don't doubt it, Jack," Adler responded. "Just remember that it won't play out quite the way you want it to." "It never does. But if they play rough, it's going to cost them $70 billion a year. We can afford to do without their products." "Can they afford to do without our money?" Ryan asked. Secretary Adler was not totally comfortable with the way the question was posed. "I suppose we'll have to wait and see." Chapter 21 Simmering. "So, what did you develop last night?" Riley asked. He'd be late to his embassy office, but his gut told him that things were breaking loose in the RPG case. That was how he thought of it. And Director Murray had a personal interest in the case, because the president did, and that made it more important than the routine bullshit on Riley's desk. "Our Chinese friend, the one in the men's room, that is the third secretary at their mission. Our friends across town at SVR have suspected that he is a member of their Ministry for State Security. He's not regarded as a particularly bright diplomat by the foreign ministry. Ours, that is." "That's how you cover a spook," Riley agreed. "A dumb cookie pusher. Okay, so he's a player." "I agree, Mishka," Provolov said. "Now it would be nice to know who passed what to whom." "Oleg Grigorievich," Riley liked the semi-formal Russian form of address. "If I'd been standing right there and staring, I might not have been able to tell." That was the problem dealing with real professionals. They were as good at that maneuver as a Las Vegas dealer was with a deck of bicycles. You needed a good lens and a slow-motion camera, to be sure, and that was a little bulky for work in the field. But they'd just proved, to their satisfaction at least, that both men were active in the spook business, and that was a break in the case any way you sliced it.
ID the girl?
Yelena Ivanova Dimitrova.
Provalov handed the folder across.
Just a whore, but of course a very expensive one.
Riley flipped it open and scanned the notes. Known prostitute specializing in foreigners. The photo of her was unusually flattering.
You came in early this morning? Riley asked.
He must have, to have all this work done already.
Before 6, Oleg confirmed.
The case was becoming more exciting for him as well.
In any case, Clementi Ivanich kept her all night. She left his apartment and caught a taxi home at 7:40 this morning. She looked happy and satisfied, according to my people.
That was good for a chuckle.
She didn't leave her trick until after Oleg hit the office.
That must have affected his attitude somewhat, Riley thought with an inward grin.
It sure as hell would have affected his.
Well, good for our subject. I expect he won't be getting too much of that in a few months, the FBI agent thought aloud, hoping it would make his Russian colleague a little happier about life.
One can hope, Provalov agreed coldly. I have 4 men watching his apartment. If he leaves and appears to be heading away for a while, I will try to get a team into his apartment to plant some electronic surveillance.
They know how to be careful? Riley asked.
If this Suvorov mutt was as trained as they thought, he'd leave telltales in his apartment that could make breaking in dicey.
They are KGB trained also. One of them helped catch a French intelligence officer back in the old times.
Now I have a question for you, the Russian cop said.
Shoot.
What do you know of a special counter-terrorist group based in England?
The Men of Black, you mean?
Provalov nodded.
Yes. Do you know anything about them?
Riley knew he had to watch his words, even though he knew damned little.
Really, I don't know anything more than what I've seen in the papers. It's some sort of multinational NATO group, part military and part police, I think. They had a good run of luck last year.
Why do you ask?
A request from on high, because I know you.
I've been told that they are coming to Moscow to assist in training our people. Spetsnaz groups with similar tasks, Oleg explained.
Really?
Well, I've never been in the muscle end of the Bureau, just in a local SWAT team once. Gus Werner probably knows a lot about them. Gus runs the new counter-terrorism division at headquarters. Before that, Gus ran HRT and had a field command. A field division, that is, a big city field office. I've met him once just to say hello. Gus has a very good service rep.
Rep?
Reputation, Oleg. He's well regarded by the field agents. But, like I said, that's the muscle end of the Bureau. I've always been with the chess players.
Investigations, you mean?
Riley nodded.
That's right. It's what the FBI is supposed to be all about. But the outfit's mutated a bit over the years.
The American paused.
So you're covering this Suvorov-Konyev guy real tight?
Riley asked, to recenter the discussion.
My men have orders to be discreet, but yes, we will keep a close eye on him, as you say.
You know, if he really is working with the Chinese spooks, do you think they might want to kill that Golovko guy?
I do not know, but we must regard that as a real possibility.
Riley nodded, thinking this would make an interesting report to send to Washington, and maybe discuss with the CIA station chief as well.
"I want the files for everyone who ever worked with him," Sergei Nikolaevich ordered. "And I want you to get me his personal file."
"Yes, Comrade Chairman," Major Shalepin replied with a bob of his head.
The morning briefing, delivered by a colonel of the militia, had pleased neither the SVR chairman nor his principal bodyguard. In this case, for a change, the legendarily slow Russian bureaucracy had been circumvented, and the information fast-tracked to those interested in it. That included the man whose life might have been spared accidentally after all.
and we will set up a special action group to work with this Provolov child.
Of course, Comrade Chairman.
It was strange, Sergei Nikolaevich thought, how rapidly the world could change. He vividly remembered the morning of the murder. It was not the sort of thing a man could forget. But after the first few days of shock and attendant fear, he'd allowed himself to relax, to believe that this Avseyenko had been the real target of an underworld rub-out, an archaic American term he liked, and that his own life had never been directly threatened. With the acceptance of that belief, the entire thing had become like driving past an ordinary traffic accident. Even if some unfortunate motorist had been killed there at the side of the road, you just dismissed it as an irrelevance, because that sort of thing couldn't happen to you in your own expensive official car, not with Anatoly driving. But now he'd begun to wonder if perhaps his life had been spared by accident. Such things were not supposed to occur. There shouldn't have been any need for them. Now he was more frightened than he'd been that bright Moscow morning, looking down from his window at the smoking wreck on the pavement. It meant that he might be in danger still, and he dreaded that prospect as much as the next man. Worse still, his hunter might well be one of his own, a former KGB officer with connections to Spetsnaz. And if he were in contact with the Chinese... But why would the Chinese wish to end his life? For that matter, why would the Chinese wish to perform any such crime in a foreign land? It was beyond imprudent. None of this made any sense. But as a career intelligence officer, Golovko had long since shed the illusion that the world was supposed to make sense. What he did know was that he needed more information, and at least he was in a very good place to seek it out. If he wasn't as powerful as he might once have been, he was still powerful enough for his own purposes, Golovko told himself. Probably. He didn't try to come to the ministry very often. It was just a routine security measure, but a sensible one. Once you recruited an agent, you didn't want to hang out with him or her for fear of compromise. That was one of the things they taught you at the farm. If you compromised one of your agents, you might have trouble sleeping at night, because CIA was usually active in countries where the Miranda warning was delivered by a gun or knife or fist, or something just as bad, as unpleasant as a police state could make it, and that, the instructors had told his class, could be pretty fucking unpleasant. Especially in a case like this, he was intimate with this agent, and breaking away from her could cause her to stop her cooperation, which Langley had told him was pretty damn good, and they wanted more of it. Erasing the program he'd had her input on her machine would be difficult for a Caltech-trained genius. But you could accomplish the same thing by clobbering the whole hard drive and reinstalling new files over the old ones, because the valuable little gopher file was hidden in the system software, and a write-over would destroy it as surely as the San Francisco earthquake. So he didn't want to be here exactly, but he was a businessman, in addition to being a spook, and the client had called him in. The girl two desks away from Ming had a computer problem, and he was the NEC rep for the ministry offices. It turned out to be a minor problem. You just couldn't turn some women loose on computers. It was like loosing a 4-year-old in a gun shop, he thought, but didn't dare say such things aloud in these liberated times, even here. Happily, Ming hadn't been in sight when he'd come in. He'd walked over to the desk with the problem and fixed it in about 3 minutes, explaining the error to the secretary in simple terms she was sure to understand, and which would now make her the office expert for an easily replicated problem. With a smile and a polite Japanese bow, he'd made his way to the door. When the door to the inner office opened, and Ming came out with her Minister Fang behind her, looking down at some papers.
"Oh, hello, Nomori-san," Ming said in surprise, as Fang called the name Chai, and waved to another of the girls to follow him in.
If Fang saw Nomori there, he didn't acknowledge it, simply disappeared back into his private office.
"Hello, Comrade Ming," the American said, speaking in English. "Your computer operates properly?" he asked formally.
"Yes, it does, thank you."
"Good. Well, if you experience a problem, you have my card."
"Oh, yes.
You are well settled into Beijing now?" she asked politely. "Yes, thank you, I am." "You should try Chinese food instead of sticking to the food of your homeland, though I admit I have developed a taste lately for Japanese sausage," she told him, and everyone else in the room, with a face that would have done Amarillo Slim proud. For his part, Chester Nomori felt his heart not so much skip a beat as stop entirely for about 10 seconds, or so it seemed. "Ah, yes," he had to say in reply, as soon as he got breath back in his lungs. "It can be very tasty." Ming just nodded and went to her desk and back to work. Nomori nodded and bowed politely to the office and made his departure as well, then headed down the corridor immediately for a men's room. The need to urinate urgent. Sweet Jesus! But that was one of the problems with agents. They sometimes got off on their work, the way a drug addict got off on the immediate rush when the chemical hit his system. And they'd tickle the dragon with their new and playful enthusiasm, just to experience a little more of the rush, forgetting that the dragon's tail was a lot closer to its mouth than it appeared. It was foolish to enjoy danger. Zipping himself back up, he told himself that he hadn't broken training, hadn't stumbled on his reply to her playful observation. But he had to warn her about dancing in a minefield. You never really knew where to put your feet, and discovering the wrong places was usually painful. That's when he realized why it had happened, and the thought stopped him dead in his tracks. Ming loved him. She was playful because, well, why else would she have said that? As a game? Did she regard the whole thing as a game? No, she wasn't the right personality type to be a hooker. The sex had been good. Maybe too good, if such a thing were possible, Nomori thought as he resumed walking toward the elevator. She'd surely be over tonight after saying that. He'd have to stop by the liquor store on the way home and get some more of that awful Japanese scotch for $30 a liter. A working man couldn't afford to get drunk here unless he drank the local stuff, and that was too vile to contemplate. But Ming had just consecrated their relationship by risking her life in front of her minister and her co-workers, and that was far more frightening to Nomori than her ill-considered remark about his dick and her fondness for it. Jesus, he thought, this is getting too serious. But what could he do now? He'd seduced her and made a spy of her, and she'd fallen for him for no better reason, probably, than that he was younger than the old fucker she worked for, and was far nicer to her. Okay, so he was pretty good in the sack, and that was excellent for his male ego. And he was a stranger in a strange land, and he had to get his rocks off, too, and doing it with her was probably safer to his cover than picking up some hooker in a bar. And he didn't even want to consider getting seriously involved with a real girl in his real life. But how was this so different from that? He asked himself. Aside from the fact that while she was loving him, her computer was sending her transcribed notes off into the ether world. It was doing it again soon after the close of regular business hours, and the 11-hour differential pretty much guaranteed that it arrived on the desks of American officials soon after their breakfasts. In the case of Mary Patricia Foley, mornings were far less hectic than they'd once been. Her youngest was not yet in college, but preferred to fix her own oatmeal from the Quaker envelopes, and now drove herself to school, which allowed her mother an extra 25 minutes or so of additional sleep every morning. 20 years of being a field spook and mother should have been enough to drive her to distracted insanity. But it was actually a life she'd enjoyed, especially her years in Moscow, doing her business right there in the belly of the beast, and giving the bastard quite an ulcer at the time, she remembered with a smile. Her husband could say much the same.
the first husband-wife team to rise so high at Langley. They drove together to work every morning, in their own car rather than the company one, to which they were entitled, but with lead and chase cars full of people with guns, because any terrorist with half a brain would regard them as targets more valuable than rubies. This way they could talk on the way in, and the car was swept for bugs on a weekly basis. They took their usual reserved and oversized place in the basement of the old headquarters building, then rode up in the executive elevator, which somehow was always waiting for them, to their seventh-floor offices. Mrs. Foley's desk was always arrayed just so. The overnight crew had all her important papers arranged just so also. But today, as she had for the last week, instead of looking over the striped border folders full of top-secret code-worded material, she first of all flipped on her desktop computer and checked her special email. This morning was no disappointment. She copied the file electronically to her hard drive, printed up a hard copy, and when that was off her printer, deleted the email from her system, effectively erasing it from electronic existence. Then she reread the paper copy and lifted the phone for her husband's office. "Yeah, baby?" "Some egg drop soup," she told the director of Central Intelligence. It was a Chinese dish he found especially vile, and she enjoyed teasing her husband. "Okay, honey, come on in." It had to be pretty good if she was trying to turn his stomach over this early in the friggin' morning, the DCI knew. "More Sorga?" the president asked, 75 minutes later. "Yes, sir," Ben Goodley replied, handing the sheet over. It wasn't long, but it was interesting. Ryan skimmed through it. "Analysis?" "Mrs. Foley wants to go over it with you this afternoon. You have a slot at 2:15. "Okay, who else?" "The vice president, since he's around." Goodley knew that Ryan liked to have Robbie Jackson in for strategically interesting material. "He's fairly free this afternoon as well." "Good. Set it up," POTUS ordered. 6 blocks away, Dan Murray was just arriving at his capacious office, considerably larger than the president's, as a matter of fact, with his own security detail, because he, as the country's principal counterintelligence and counter-terrorist officer, had all manner of information that others were interested in. This morning only brought in some more. "Morning, Director," one of the staff said. She was a sworn agent carrying a sidearm, not just a secretary. "Hey, Tony," Murray responded. This agent had very nice wheels, but the FBI director realized that he'd just proven to himself that his wife Liz was right. He was turning into a dirty old man. The piles on the desk were arranged by the overnight staff, and there was a routine for this. The rightwardmost pile was for intelligence-related material, the leftwardmost for counterintelligence operations, and the big one in the middle was for ongoing criminal investigations requiring his personal attention or notification. That tradition went back to Mr. Hoover, as he was remembered at the FBI, who seemingly went over every field case bigger than the theft of used cars off the government parking lot. But Murray had long worked the black side of the bureau, and that meant he attacked the rightward pile first. There wasn't much there. The FBI was running some of its own pure intelligence operations at the moment, somewhat to the discomfort of CIA, but those two government agencies had never gotten along terribly well, even though Murray rather liked the Foleys. What the hell, he thought. A little competition was good for everybody, so long as CIA didn't mess with a criminal investigation, which would be a very different kettle of fish. The top report was from Mike Riley in Moscow. "Damn," Murray breathed. Then an inward smile. Murray had personally selected Riley for the Moscow slot, over the objections of some of his senior people, who had all wanted Paul Landau out of the intelligence division. But no, Murray had decided, Moscow needed help with cop work, not spy chasing, at which they had lots of good experience. And so he'd sent Mike, a second-generation agent who, like his father, Pat Riley, had given the mafia in New York City a serious case of indigestion. Landau was now in Berlin, playing with the German Bundeskriminalamt, the BKA, doing regular crime liaison stuff, and doing it pretty well. But Riley was a potential star. His dad had retired an ASAC. Mike would do better than that. And the way he'd bonded with this Russian detective, Provolov, wouldn't hurt his career one bit. So, they'd uncovered a link between a former KGB officer and the Chinese MSSA, and this was part of the investigation into the big kaboom in Moscow. Jesus, could the Chinese have had a part in that? If so, what the hell did that mean? Now this was something the Foleys had to see. To that end, Director Murray lifted his phone. 10 minutes later, the Moscow document slid into his secure fax machine to Langley. And, just to make sure that CIA didn't take credit for an FBI job, a hard copy was hand-carried to the White House, where it was handed to Dr. Benjamin Goodley, who'd surely show it to the President before lunch. It had gotten to the point that he recognized her knock at the door. Nomori set his drink down and jumped to answer, pulling it open less than 5 seconds after the first sexy tap-tap.
"Ming," Chet said.
"Nomori-san," she greeted in turn.
He pulled her in the door, closed and locked it. Then he lifted her off the floor with a passionate hug that was less than 3% feigned.
"So you have a taste for Japanese sausage, eh?" he demanded, with a smile and a kiss.
"You didn't even smile when I said it."
"Wasn't it funny?" she asked, as he undid a few of her buttons.
"Ming."
He hesitated and tried something he'd learned earlier in the day.
"Baobei,"
he said instead. It translated to "beloved one." Ming smiled at the words and made her own reply.
"Shingan,"
which literally meant heart and liver, but in context meant heart and soul.
"Beloved one," Nomori said after a kiss.
"Do you advertise our relationship at your office?"
"No. Minister Fang might not approve. But the other girls in the office probably would not object if they found out," she explained with a coquettish smile.
"But you never know."
"Then why risk exposing yourself by making such a joke, unless you wish me to betray you?"
"You have no sense of humor," Ming observed.
But then she ran her hands under his shirt and up his chest.
"But that is all right. You have the other things I need."
Afterward, it was time to do business.
"Baobei?"
"Yes?"
"Your computer still works properly?"
"Oh, yes,"
she assured him in a sleepy voice. His left hand stroked her body gently. "Do any of the other girls in the office use their computers to surf the net?"
"Only Chai. Fang uses her as he uses me. In fact, he likes her better. He thinks she has a better mouth."
"Oh?" Nomori asked, softening the question with a smile.
"I told you, Minister Fang is an old man. Sometimes he needs special encouragement, and Chai doesn't mind so much. Fang reminds her of her grandfather, she says," Ming told him.
Which was good in the American's mind for a yuck and little else. "So, all the girls in the office trade notes on your minister?" Ming laughed. It was pretty funny.
"Of course. We all do."
Damn, Nomori thought. He'd always thought that women would be more discreet, that it was just the men who bragged in the locker room over their sweat socks.
"The first time he did me," she went on, "I didn't know what to do. So I talked with Chai for advice. She's been there the longest, you see.
She just said to enjoy it and try to make him happy. And I might get a nice office chair out of it, like she did. Chai must be very good to him. She got a new bicycle last November. Me, well, I think he only likes me because I'm a little different to look at. Chai has bigger breasts than I do, and I think I'm prettier. But she has a sweet disposition, and she likes the old man. More than I do, anyway. She paused. I don't want a new bicycle enough for that.
What does this mean? Robbie Jackson asked.
Well, we're not sure, the DCI admitted. This Fung guy had a long talk with our old friend Zhang Hansan. They're talking about the meeting with our trade team that starts tomorrow.
Hell, Ed Foley looked at his watch, call that 14 hours from now.
And it looks as though they want concessions from us instead of offering any to us. They're even angrier over our recognition of Taiwan than we'd anticipated.
Tough shit, Ryan observed.
Jack, I agree with your sentiment, but let's try not to be over-cavalier about their opinions, shall we? Foley suggested.
You're starting to sound like Scott, the president said.
So, you want a yes-man handling Langley? You got the wrong guy, the DCI countered.
Fair enough, Ed, Jack conceded. Go on.
Jack, we need to warn Rutledge that the PRC isn't going to like what he has to say. They may not be in a mood to make any trade concessions.
Well, neither is the United States of America, Ryan told his director of Central Intelligence. And we come back to the fact that they need our money more than we need their trade goods.
What's the chance that this is a setup? This information, I mean, Vice President Jackson asked.
You mean that they're using this source as a conduit to get back-channel information to us? Mary Patricia Foley asked.
I evaluate that chance as practically zero. As close to zero as something in the real world can be.
MP, how can you be that confident? President Ryan asked.
Not here, Jack, but I am that confident, Mary Pat said, somewhat to the discomfort of her husband, Ryan saw. It was rare in the intelligence community for anyone to feel that confident about anything. But Ed had always been the careful one, and Mary Pat had always been the cowgirl. She was as loyal to her people as a mother was to her infant. And Ryan admired that, even though he also had to remind himself that it wasn't always realistic.
Ed, Ryan asked, just to see.
I back Mary up on this one. This source appears to be gold-plated and copper-bottomed.
So, this document represents the view of their government? Tomcat asked.
Foley surprised the vice president by shaking his head.
No, it represents the view of this Zhang Hansan guy. He's a powerful and influential minister, but he doesn't speak for their government per se.
Note that the text here doesn't say what their official position is. Zhang probably does represent a view, and a powerful view, inside their Politburo. There are also moderates whose position this document does not address.
Okay, great, Robbie said, shifting in his seat.
So why are you taking up our time with this stuff, then? This Zhang guy is tight with their defense minister. In fact, he has a major voice in their entire national security establishment. If he's expanding his influence into trade policy, we have a problem. And our trade negotiations team needs to know that up front, the DCI informed them.
So? Ming asked tiredly.
She hated getting dressed and leaving, and it meant a night of not enough sleep.
So you should get in early and upload this on Chai's computer. It's just a new system file, the new one. 6.8.1, like the one I uploaded on your computer.
In fact, the newest real system file was 6.3.2, and so there was at least a year until a write-over would actually be necessary.
Why do you have me do this?
Does it matter, Baobei? He asked.
She actually hesitated, thinking it over a bit, and the second or so of uncertainty chilled the American spy.
No, I suppose not.
"'I need to get you some new things,' Nomori whispered, taking her in his arms.
"'Like what?' she asked.
All his previous gifts had been noteworthy.
"'It will be a surprise, and a good one,' he promised.
Her dark eyes sparkled with anticipation. Nomori helped her on with her dreadful jacket. Dressing her back up was not nearly as fun as undressing her, but that was to be expected. A moment later he gave her the final goodbye kiss at the door, and watched her depart, then went back to his computer to tell Pat's Bakery at BrownieNet.com that he'd arranged for a second recipe that he hoped she might find tasty. Chapter 22 The Table and the Recipe.
"'Minister, this is a pleasure,' Cliff Rutledge said in his friendliest diplomatic voice, shaking hands. Rutledge was glad the PRC had adopted the Western custom. He'd never learned the exact protocol of bowing. Carl Hitch, the U.S. ambassador to the People's Republic, was there for the opening ceremony. He was a career Foreign Service officer who'd always preferred working abroad to working at Foggy Bottom. Running day-to-day diplomatic relations wasn't especially exciting, but in a place like this it did require a steady hand. Hitch had that, and he was apparently well-liked by the rest of the diplomatic community, which didn't hurt. It was all new for Mark Gant, however. The room was impressive, like the boardroom of a major corporation. Designed to keep the board members happy, like noblemen from medieval Italy. It had high ceilings and fabric-covered walls. Chinese silk, in this case. Red, of course, so that the effect was rather like crawling inside the heart of a whale, complete with chandeliers, cut crystal, and polished brass. Everyone had a tiny glass of Mao Tai, which really was like drinking flavored lighter fluid, as he'd been warned.
"'It is your first time in Beijing?' some minor official asked him.
Gant turned to look down at the little guy.
"'Yes, it is.'
"'Too soon for first impressions, then?'
"'Yes, but this room is quite stunning. But then silk is something with which your people have a long and fruitful history,' he went on, wondering if he sounded diplomatic or merely awkward.
"'This is so, yes,' the official agreed with a toothy grin and a nod, neither of which told the visiting American much of anything. Except that he didn't waste much money on toothbrushes.
"'I have heard much of the Imperial Art Collection.'
"'You will see it,' the official promised. "'It is part of the official program.
"'Excellent. In addition to my duties, I would like to play tourist.'
"'I hope you will find us acceptable hosts,' the little guy said.
For his part, Gant was wondering if this smiling, bowing dwarf would hit his knees and offer a blowjob. But diplomacy was an entirely new area for him. These were not investment bankers who were generally polite sharks, giving you good food and drink before sitting you down and trying to bite your dick off. But they never concealed the fact that they were sharks. These people, he just wasn't sure. This degree of politeness and solicitude was a new experience for Gant. But given his pre-mission brief, he wondered if the hospitality only presaged an unusually hostile meeting when they got to business. If the two things had to balance out, then the downside of this seesaw was going to be a son of a bitch, he was sure.
"'So you are not from the American State Department?' the Chinese man asked.
"'No, I am in the Department of the Treasury.' I work directly for Secretary Winston.
Ah, then you are from the trading business.
So the little bastard's been briefed. But that was to be expected. At this level of government you didn't freelance things. Everyone would be thoroughly briefed. Everyone would have read the book on the Americans. The State Department members of the American crew had done the same. Gant, however, had not. Since he wasn't really a player, per se, and had only been told what he needed to know. That gave him an advantage over the Chinese assigned to look after him. He was not State Department,
hence should not have been regarded as important. But he was the personal representative of a very senior American official, known to be part of that man's inner circle, and that made him very important indeed. Perhaps he was even a principal advisor to the Rutledge man. And, in a Chinese context, that might even mean that he, Gant, was the man actually running the negotiations, rather than the titular chief diplomat, because the Chinese often ran things that way. It occurred to Gant that maybe he could fuck with their minds a little bit, but how to go about it? "Oh, yes, I've been a capitalist all my life," Gant said, deciding to play it cool and just talk to the guy as though he were a human being and not a fucking communist diplomat. "So has Secretary Winston, and so has our president, you know." "But he was mainly an intelligence officer, or so I have been told." Time to stick the needle. "I suppose that's partly true, but his heart is in business, I think. After he leaves government service, he and George will probably go into business together and really take the world over." Which was almost true, Gant thought, remembering that the best lies usually were. "And you have worked some years with Secretary Winston?" A statement rather than a question, Gant noted. How to answer it? How much did they really know about him? Or was he a man of mystery to the Chi-Coms? If so, could he make that work for him? A gentle, knowing smile. "Well, yeah, George and I made a little money together. When Jack brought him into the cabinet, George decided that he wanted me to come down with him and help make a little government policy, especially tax policy. That's been a real mess, and George turned me loose on it. And you know, we just might get all of that changed. It looks as though Congress is going to do what we told them to do, and that's not bad, making those idiots do what we want them to do," Gant observed, looking rather deliberately at the carved ivory fixture on the wooden display cabinet. Some craftsman with a sharp knife had spent a lot of time to get that thing just right. "So, Mr. Chinaman, do I look important now?" One thing about this guy, he would have been a pretty good poker player. His eyes told you nothing at all. Not a fucking thing. Gant looked down at the guy again. "Excuse me, I talk too much." The official smiled. "There is much of that at times like this. Why do you suppose everyone gets something to drink?" Amusement in his voice, letting Gant know, perhaps, who was really running this affair. "I suppose," Gant observed diffidently, and wandered off with the junior, or was he, official in tow. For his part, Rutledge was trying to decide if the opposition knew what his instructions were. There had been a few leaked hints in the media, but Adler had arranged the leaks with skill, so that even a careful observer, and the PRC ambassador in Washington was one of those, might have trouble deciding who was leaking what, and to what purpose. The Ryan administration had utilized the press with a fair degree of skill, probably, Rutledge thought, because the cabinet officers mainly took their lead from Ryan's chief of staff, Arnie Van Dam, who was a very skillful political operator. The new cabinet didn't have the usual collection of in-and-out political figures who needed to stroke the press to further their own agendas. Ryan had chiefly selected people with no real agenda at all, which was no small feat, especially since most of them seemed to be competent technicians, who, like Ryan, only seemed to want to escape Washington with their virtue intact and return to their real lives as soon as they finished serving their country for a short period of time. The career diplomat had not thought it possible that his country's government could be so transformed. He assigned credit for all this to that madman Japanese pilot who'd killed so much of official Washington in that one lunatic gesture. It was then that Xu Kun Piao showed up, sweeping into the greeting room with his official entourage. Xu was General Secretary of the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China, and Chairman of the Chinese Politburo, though referred to in the media as the country's premier, which was something of a misnomer, but one adopted even in the diplomatic community. He was a man of 71 years, one of the second generation of Chinese leaders. The Long March survivors had long since died out. There were some senior officials who claimed to have been there, but a check of the numbers showed that if they had, they'd been sucking their mother's nipples at the time, and those men were not taken seriously. No, the current crop of Chinese political leaders were mainly the sons or nephews of the original set, raised in privilege and relative comfort, but always mindful of the fact that their place in life was a precarious one. On one side were the other political children who craved advancement beyond their parents' places, and, to achieve that, they'd been more Catholic than the local communist pope. They'd carried their little red books high as adults during the Cultural Revolution. And before that, they'd kept their mouths shut and ears open during the abortive and predatory Hundred Flowers campaign of the late 50s, which had trapped a lot of intellectuals who'd thought to keep hidden for the first decade of Maoist rule. They'd been enticed into the open by Mao's own solicitation for their ideas, which they'd foolishly given out, and in the process only extended their necks over the broad block for the axe that fell a few years later in the brutal, cannibalistic Cultural Revolution. The current Politburo members had survived in two ways. First, they'd been secured by their fathers and the rank that attached to such lofty parentage. Second, they'd been carefully warned about what they could say and what they could not say. And so all along they'd observed cautiously, always saying out loud that Chairman Mao's ideas were those which China really needed, and that the others, while interesting, perhaps, in a narrow intellectual sense, were dangerous insofar as they distracted the workers and peasants from the true way of Mao. And so when the axe had fallen, born as it had been by the little red book, they'd been among the first to carry and show that book to others, and so escaped the destruction for the most part. A few of their number had been sacrificed, of course, but none of the really smart ones who now shared the seats on the Politburo. It had been a brutal Darwinian process that they had all gotten through by being a little smarter than those around them. And now, at the peak of the power won for them by brains and caution, it was time for them to enjoy that which they'd earned. The new crop of leaders accepted communism as truly as other men believed in God, because they'd learned nothing else, and had not exercised their intellectual agility to seek another faith, or even to seek solutions to the questions that Marxism could not answer. Theirs was a faith of resignation rather than enthusiasm. Raised within a circumscribed intellectual box, they never ventured out of it, for they feared what they might find out there. In the past 20 years, they'd been forced to allow capitalism to blossom within the borders of their country, because that country needed money to grow into something more powerful than the failed experiment in the Democratic Republic of Korea. China had experienced its own killer famine around 1960, and slowly learned from it, and the Chinese also used it as a launching point for the Cultural Revolution, thus gaining political capital from a self-imposed disaster. They wanted their nation to be great. In fact, they already regarded it as such, but recognized the fact that other nations lacked this appreciation, and so they had to seek out the means to correct the misimpression foolishly held by the rest of the world. That had meant money, and money had meant industry, and industry required capitalists. It was something they had figured out before the foolish Soviets to their north and west. And so the Soviet Union had fallen, but the People's Republic of China remained. Or so they all believed. They looked out, when they bothered themselves to do so, at a world that they pretended to understand, and to which they felt superior for no better reason than their skin and their language. Ideology came second in their self-reckoning. Amour propre starts from within. They expected people to defer to them, and the previous years of interactive diplomacy with the surrounding world had not altered their outlook very much. But in this they suffered from their own illusions. Henry Kissinger had come to China in 1971 at the behest of President Richard Nixon, not so much from his perceived need to establish normal relations with the world's most populous nation, as to use the PRC as a stick with which to beat the Soviet Union into submission. In fact, Nixon had begun a process so lengthy as to be considered beyond Western capabilities. It was more the sort of thing that Westerners thought the Chinese themselves capable of conceiving. With such ideas, people merely show ethnic prejudices of one sort or another. The typical chief of a totalitarian government is far too self-centered to think much beyond his own lifetime. And men all over the world live roughly the same number of years. For that simple reason, they all think in terms of programs that can be completed in their own living sight, and little beyond, because they were all men who'd torn down the statues of others, and such men had few illusions over the fate of their own monuments. It was only as they faced death that they considered what they had done, and Mao had conceded bleakly to Henry Kissinger that all he'd accomplished had been to change the lives of peasants within a few miles of Beijing. But the men in this ceremonial room were not yet close enough to death to think in such terms. They were the magisters of their land. They made the rules that others followed. Their words were law. Their whims were granted with alacrity. People looked upon them as they once looked upon the emperors and princes of old. All a man could wish to have, they had. Most of all, they had the power. It was their wishes that ruled their vast and ancient land. Their communist ideology was merely the magic that defined the form their wishes took, the rules of the game they had all agreed to play all those years before. The power was the thing. They could grant life or take it with the stroke of a pen, or, more realistically, a dictated word, taken down by a personal secretary, for transmission to the underling who squeezed the trigger. Xu was a man of average everything, height, weight, eyes and face, and intellect, some said. Rutledge had read all this in his briefing documents. The real power was elsewhere. Xu was a figurehead of sorts, chosen for his looks, partially, his ability to give a speech, certainly, and his ability to front the occasional idea of others on the Politburo, to simulate conviction. Like a Hollywood actor, he didn't so much have to be smart as to play smart. "Comrade Premier," Rutledge said in greeting, holding out his hand, which the Chinese man took. "Mr. Rutledge," Xu replied in passable English. There was an interpreter there, too, for the more complex thoughts. "Welcome to Beijing. It is my pleasure and my honor to visit your ancient country again," the American diplomat said, showing proper respect and subservience, the Chinese leader thought. "It is always a pleasure to welcome a friend," Xu went on, as he'd been briefed to do. Rutledge had been to China before in his official capacity, but never before as a delegation leader. He was known to the Chinese Foreign Ministry as a diplomat who'd climbed his way up the ladder of his bureaucracy, much as they did in their own. A mere technician, but a high-ranking one. The Politburo chief raised his glass. "I drink to successful and cordial negotiations." Rutledge smiled and hoisted his glass as well. "As do I, sir." The cameras got it. The news media people were circulating around, too. The cameramen were doing mainly what they called locator shots, like any amateur would do with his less expensive minicam. They showed the room at an artificial distance, so that the viewers could see the colors, with a few close-ups of the furniture on which no one was supposed to sit, with somewhat closer shots of the major participants drinking their drinks and looking pleasant to one another. This was called B-roll, intended to show viewers what it was like to be at a large, formal, and not overly pleasant cocktail party. The real news coverage for the event would be by people like Barry Wise and the other talking heads, who would tell the viewer what the visuals could not. Then the coverage would shift back to CNN's Washington studio, down the hill from Union Station, where other talking heads would discuss what had been leaked or not leaked to them, then discuss what they, in their personal sagacious wisdom, thought the proper course for the United States of America ought to be. President Ryan would see all this over breakfast, as he read the papers and the government-produced early bird clipping service. Over breakfast, Jack Ryan would make his own terse comments to be noted by his wife, who might discuss it over lunch with her colleagues at Johns Hopkins, who might discuss it with their spouses, from whom it would go no farther. In this way, the president's thoughts often remained a mystery. The party broke up at the predetermined hour, and the Americans headed back to the embassy in their official cars. "So, what can you tell us off the record?" Barry asked Rutledge, in the sanctity of the stretch Lincoln's back seat. "Not much, really," the Assistant Secretary of State for Policy replied. "We'll listen to what they have to say, and they'll listen to what we have to say, and it'll go from there." "They want MFN. Will they get it?" "That's not for me to decide, Barry, and you know that." Rutledge was too tired and jet-lagged for intelligent conversation at the moment. He didn't trust himself to speak under these circumstances, and figured Wise knew that. The reporter was leaning on him for just that reason. "So, what are you going to talk about?" "Obviously, we'd like the Chinese to open their markets more, and also to take a closer look at some issues we have, like patent and copyright violations that American business has complained about." "The Dell computer issue?" Rutledge nodded. "Yes, that's one." Then he yawned. "Excuse me, the long flight. You know how it is." "I was on the same airplane," Barry Wise pointed out. "Well, maybe you're just better at this than I am," Rutledge offered. "Can we postpone this discussion a day or so?" "If you say so," the CNN reporter agreed. He didn't much like this preppy asshole, but he was a source of information, and Wise was in the information business. The ride was a brief one, in any case. The official delegation hopped out at the embassy, and the embassy cars took the newsies back to their hotels. The embassy had sleeping accommodations for the entire official party, mainly to ensure that anything they said wouldn't be recorded by the MSS bugs in every hotel room in the city. This was not to say that the accommodations were palatial, though Rutledge had a comfortable room. Here protocol failed Mark Gant, but he did have a comfortable single bed in his small private room and a shared bathroom with a shower. He opted instead for a hot bath and one of the sleeping pills the physician who accompanied the official party had issued him. It was supposed to give him a solid 8 hours or so, which would just about synchronize him with local time by the morning. There would then be a big working breakfast, much like the astronauts got before a shuttle launch, and as much of an American tradition as the Stars and Stripes over Fort McHenry. Nomori caught the arrival of the trade delegation on Chinese TV, which he watched mainly to hone his language skills. These were improving, though the tonal nature of Mandarin drove him slightly nuts. He'd once thought Japanese was hard, but it was a walk in the park compared to Goryeo. He looked at the faces, wondering who they were. The Chinese narrator helped, stumbling badly over Rutledge, however. Well, Americans murdered Chinese names, too, except for simple ones like Ming and Wang. And listening to an American businessman try to make himself understood to a local was enough to make Nomori gag. The commentator went on to talk about the Chinese position on the trade talks, how America owed the PRC all manner of concessions. After all, was not China generous in allowing Americans to spend their worthless dollars for the valuable products of the People's Republic? In this, China sounded a lot like Japan had once done. But the new Japanese government had opened up their markets. While there was still a trade deficit in Japan's favor, fair competition on the playing field had muted American criticism, though Japanese cars were still less welcome in America than they had been. But that would pass, Nomori was sure. If America had a weakness, it was in forgiving and forgetting too rapidly. In this, he greatly admired the Jews. They still hadn't forgotten Germany.